Hello, I am Jamie from Stonemaier Games, and today we have one of the most requested videos that I've seen on this channel, which is people asking me to rank all 17 games that Stonemaier Games has released over the last 12 years. I have avoided this question because it's really tough for me to work these games that I've spent so much time and energy and love ranking. But I thought that there might be a loophole recently that I realized, which could be that I could find people who have played all 17 Stonemaier games, and I could ask them to rank the games, and I could slip my own rankings into that overall formula. So I found 20 different Stonemaier ambassadors who have actually played all 17 Stonemaier games, and how many? Five of them are here with me today to talk about and rank the 17 games that Stonemaier Games has. We're going to talk about the bottom seven and then the top four through 10. And then we'll spend a lot of time or more time on the top three. Let's jump right in with, and let me share my other screen here to show you how we'll do this today. So I have this little ranking system that Ambassador Garrett put together for us. And the first game that we're going to talk about today is Smitten. Where can I find Smitten on here? Here's Smitten. Smitten is a 1-2 player cooperative game that that has players trying to complete two grids. In fact, you can kind of see it maybe on camera right behind me here. This is part of Smitten. And to share the most important thing, we're going to take turns talking about what we think is the most important thing to share about each of these games is Jonathan. So Jonathan's going to join us here to share the most important thing about Smitten. Thank you, Jonathan, for joining us today.
Yeah. Thank you, Jamie, for inviting me. This is really a great opportunity. So yeah, talking about Smitten, you covered what it is. It's just a really nice co-op game to play with a spouse, a friend, you know, anybody that you can get together with. And it just does a nice job of paying tribute to all the Stonemaier games. It was a wonderful gift when it came out, you know, I think a year or so ago. And it's just one that easy to play, easy to get on the table, and always fun to come back to. So I really appreciate this game for real.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'd also say it's the most travel friendly of all of our games. It's the only game that can truly fit in your pocket.
Absolutely.
Of all of our games.
Awesome. Truly, yes.
Well, Jonathan's going to hang around with us. I'm going to be adding people as we go. Thank you for your thoughts on Smitten, Jonathan. The next two, so we have someone who's going to talk about the next two. The next two games are My Little Scythe. Here we go. I'll slide it over here. My Little Scythe and at 16 and Pendulum at 15. Let's see if I can get it to slide over. There we go. So here to talk about these two games, who do we have for these two? We have Chris. So Chris is going to talk about these two games. Thanks, Chris, for joining us.
Hello. I'll tackle My Little Scythe first. It's just an incredibly charming game. I have it, I think, ranked 14 on my list, but that's just because it's not a game I'm going to take out with my game group, but I've had a ton of fun with it with my son in particular. Even before he was able to play the game, he loved taking out the figures. I have them all painted here. Here's a couple of my favorites. And we would just turn the board upside down and play on the backside of the board. He'd have fun with it just as a toy. And then when he was able to follow the rules of the game, it's one of the first games he took out and was able to play by the rules as written, and I've had a lot of fun with that. So with younger kids, it's definitely a high recommend.
I should have clarified, Chris, sorry. Yeah, so My Little Scythe is a distilled family version of our game Scythe that we'll talk about a little bit later. It uses grids, you're collecting resources a little bit. Pendulum, that Chris is about to talk about, is a game that uses timers. It's an engine-building worker placement game. So Chris, yeah, what's the most important thing for people to know about Pendulum?
So Pendulum, I think, I've had a lot of pushback on Pendulum because some of the way that the game ends is a little bit out of the ordinary, but I think giving it its shot, and I believe there's an official variant that lets you go beyond the normal endpoint. You add those in, and it's just such a unique real-time game where everybody is all engaged the entire time. I've pulled it out with from two to five players, and it's just so unique in the way that you have to sit there and wait for this action that you're really want to get done, but then you're forgetting about this timer going off in the other corner over there, and it just adds a lot of tension that's really unique.
That's a great summary of it. Yeah, a lot of tension, elements of timing in Pendulum with those timers. Well, thank you, Chris. Chris is going to stick around, and we're going to talk about the next two games on the list, which are share similar DNA, share the same designers as well. So we have Between Two Cities at number 14, and at number 13, we have Between Two Castles, which is, these are both tile drafting games where you are working with the player on your right and your left in a competitive game to build two different cities or castles, depending on the game. And at the end of the game, you only score the lower of the two cities or castles, depending on the game that you're playing. So joining us for this one is Christian. Christian, thanks for joining us today.
Yes. Hey, all. Again, thanks for having me as well. Yes, as you already said, Between Two Castles and Between Two Cities share kind of the same DNA. And maybe one of the reasons we play so many Stonemaier games is they scale well with many players. And those two even go up to 7 players. And they're really easy to get to the table because, for once, the insert from Between Two Castles, you just put it on the table and can start to play. And Between Two Cities as well. And both have this unique, unique mechanism where you can play with your partner and build your same city or castle. And that's also very good to get to bring to new players to the table. Because you can sit the better players next to the newer ones. And yeah, you're good to go and have a nice time with a light starting gateway game with Between Two Cities and a maybe more advanced version with Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig.
These are two of my favorite games to send to classrooms when we have teachers request games for us, because I think they move along quickly and they're really good at fostering communication, because you have to balance communication between two players. Awesome. Thank you, Christian. Like everybody else, Christian's going to stick around for the rest of this discussion. At number 12, we have Libertalia, the first time we've ever taken a game that was originally released by another publisher, and we created our own edition of it and added a lot to the game, in my opinion. So here to talk about Libertalia is Mikkel. Here we go. Hello.
Hello. Well, thanks for having me on. Libertalia is so easy to explain. It's like, all right, you have these characters. They go from 1 to 40. Shuffle your deck. We all have the 6 starting characters. So you all have the same character to begin with. But then you play them. And then some of them bounce each other back. And some of them manipulate the board. And it's still so easy to explain. And either you get an early character that does something cool, or you get a late character that's one of the first to select these treasures, these nice tiles. And after the first round, people have different characters left. And then you add 6 new characters, and you can't remember which character went where. And people are constantly forgetting which characters you have. And I hate memory in games. I really don't like when I need to remember something I could be tracking. But this game is designed to not allow you to track what you want to track, so you can never remember it. So it's just, it takes, I don't know, 1 minute, 2 minutes to explain everything. But there's so much change over those 3 rounds you are playing. It's really a development throughout the game, I think. And that's one of the main reasons that I still think it works, is that you also collect a lot of treasure, but in the end, treasure is converted into points. So there's a lot of fighting for treasure during the game. But then at the end of the round, everything more or less resets into victory points. And then you start over again.
I will. Thank you for that description. I thought that was a great description. Libertalia really opened my mind to what a game could be when I originally played it. And it was one of the great pleasures of my life to work with the designer to release our version of it. Last but not least, Michael's been waiting very patiently here. The last game that we have, let me add Michael to the stage here, is Euphoria. So we have Euphoria at number 11. Michael is at number 11. Hopefully you can hear me right now. Could you let me know your thoughts, or the most important thing, about Euphoria?
Yeah, thank you for having me here. Euphoria is a great game for thematic involvement. So the tagline is build a better dystopia, and it works in really well with a worker placement game where a key component is keeping your workers, your population, kind of dumb. And benefits if they're smart, but they might also run away. It was just a really unique way and a really fun way to build on the worker placement idea. It's also again, the dystopian theme really shines in it with, you have an underground civilization, one in the sky. They're just, they're all over the place. It's asymmetrical. So you build from different areas and just ends up giving a really unique take on that worker placement concept.
Awesome. Thank you, Michael. Yeah, this was this is the first game that I designed after Viticulture, worker placement game with dice. And I would say it's one of the harder games to teach from Stillmeyer Games, even though it is not one of the heaviest games that we have. But yeah, I'm glad that we have it in our lineup. All right, so that is 11 through 17. Everyone is here now, and we're going to talk about games ranked 10 to 4 from the 20 Stillmeyer Ambassadors who have played all 17 Stillmeyer games. Let's start, and this is a surprise. People, everyone watching, everyone joining me here does not know exactly how these rankings ended up. So let's go over here and add number 10, which is Charterstone. Which of you has most recently played Charterstone, do you think, and if you want to talk about it?
Just finished it in December, actually.
In December. All right. Well, what do you think? So Charterstone is a worker placement legacy game. It's a 12-game campaign. Plays up to 6 players. Here we go. We have it. Chris is showing off what it looks here. It looks
this like is my it, copy right? with half a trink removed because I have not yet played this copy.
But yeah, Michael, what's your favorite thing about this worker placement legacy game, Charterstone?
Obviously, I like the worker placement games, but the legacy component was very interesting in this with building out the board as you go. So the spaces where you can place your workers, everyone has their own little territory. And as you play through the game, it evolves and you put new buildings out, you overwrite other buildings. So slight spoiler, halfway through the game, you get islands that float that you can move around every game. So every single play throughout is you're trying to give yourself the best advantage, but also not give your opponents too much of an advantage. It's a really cool balancing act. Looking forward to playing it a second time with our group just for the, we got the bad ending. Hopefully we can get the happy ending next time.
Does anyone else have any thoughts about Charterstone that you think people would want to know if they haven't played it?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's a great game to get people into a legacy game. It's a great worker placement, great legacy style game, great with families of any age, really, to get them started. And when you're all done, you've got a board that you can play that's unique to you. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can agree on that. We actually played it with a friend who never plays board games and always said, hey, can I join your group? I want to play a game. And we right went to the legacy game, which was my second experience for a legacy game at that time. Yeah, and we did the whole campaign and had a good time. Still using the coins.
Oh, nice. Yeah, one of the things, I put metal coins in every copy of Charterstone because I figured even if people end up not playing the game after they're done the campaign, they could use those coins for another game and have that kind of legacy component carry over to other games. So yeah, that's Charterstone at number 10. Let's go back to the list now. Number 9 is Red Rising, one of the few games, and really the major game that we have based on another intellectual property. So Red Rising is a hand management game heavily inspired by a game called Fantasy Realms and also inspired by the Red Rising novel series that I fell in love with. Who of you, let's see, someone who maybe hasn't talked, Mikkel or Chris, do you have any thoughts on Red Rising?
I have to admit, it's a bit in the same line as Libertalia. Again, a game that's so easy to explain. All right, there are these different colors, but you don't need to know that. Everything is on the cards. Just do what the card says. Don't try and interpret anything. Just do exactly what it says. There are these endgame conditions tied to colors, tied to goals. So it's, again, it's so simple. I really enjoy these simple games where they're easy to explain but hard to master. And those are the most difficult games to make. And maybe Red Rising doesn't have an, I wouldn't say like an infinite solution space, or you can play it like 15 times in a row. It's a game we bring forth, play it 2-3 times, all right, new strategies, and then it's good for a week, but it's still a really tight design. There's a lot going on with that one deck of cards.
I'll have to say that I read the Red Rising series after Jamie recommended it before the game was released. And I just love digging through the cards and seeing all the little nods to, without spoiling any book plots, all the little characters that connect together. And it's like, oh, this is why these two synergize together, because they did this in the book. And there's just so much love and attention put into that game that if you have read the books, it definitely heightens it, but it doesn't require you to have that back knowledge.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, that Red Rising was a lot of fun to design. It took me quite a while to figure out how to make the game come to life. And I continue to enjoy the book series too. The author has released through book six, and there's a book seven to eventually come out as well. Let's jump over and look at number eight on the list is the game that I have played the most out of any of these games, and that is Rolling Realms. I play Rolling Realms every 2 to 3 weeks. I live cast it or live stream it. So this is definitely my most played Stonemaier game. Would anyone like to share what they think is? Oh, and the idea behind Rolling Realms is it is an infinitely scaling roll and write game that out of the box plays up to six players, where a player rolls two D6 dice and all players use the numbers on those dice on a combination of three realm cards. You can play a single round or you can play a full game, which is three rounds. Do any of you have anything that you'd like to share that you think is the most important thing for people to know about Rolling Realms?
As you said, you play it quite often. I don't know how it's in the US, but in Germany, Yahtzee is kind of a popular game. And this replaced that for us a long time ago. And it's the second most vacation-friendly game, I think. We take it everywhere we go and always find new players. It's still fun to play. I've got all the promos, I have to admit. Still five or six I have not played yet, but yeah, they're all great. It's a very cool design of a game to still can add to that. And very excited for Rolling Realms Redux.
Yeah. This is one of the games where it convinced me that I didn't need to purchase absolutely every product you make. So I don't have all the promos, but it is a great game with, you know, even just out of the box, games that come with it, just to like play while you're waiting for the rest of your group to come, or you don't want to stay for too long at the end of the night to just end the night. You can play the full three rounds or just one round while you're waiting. Like you can scale it up to your needs. It plays as many people as you have the little whiteboard for. And it's a fun little, like you don't it seek out to publish many fillers, but it works in that niche.
Yeah, and then again, with all the promo realms added, you actually get some of that complexity, and the combination of realms mean that like a true random draw can really change the game from something that's resource heavy or resource deficit. So it's there's a lot of experience in that space with just three realms.
Yeah,
and one of the fun
things.
Oh, go ahead.
Those bad draws where you can't get like stars in two realms at once or something actually make the game more interesting. Everybody has the same realm, so it's balanced. Mm-hmm. But when everybody gets maximum stars, that's a lackluster round. But when it's not perfectly balanced, it gets better.
Yeah. This is also one of the interesting games. A lot of our games have fan creations that have emerged from the original game, core game and the expansions. But this game, I think, maybe has more fan-created content than any other game, with a lot of people taking a game that they love and just designing a realm based on that game. Jonathan, you designed the Tricarion realm, right?
Is that it's okay. I just wanted to talk about this is one that I had ranked pretty high for me. It means a lot to me. I designed the Tricarion realm, got to work with Jamie and Carell several years ago, and it's just a really, really incredible experience to take, you know, the creativity. And I wanted to ask you a question, Jamie. Did that surprise you, the number of fan realms that it spawned? Because I know it was a game you designed during COVID. It's a wonderful game for just the 11 Stonemaier games at the time. And, you know, just seeing that creativity from so many people, there's over 100 fan realms, some got published. How does that make you feel? Like, what does that, you know, inspire from you, I guess, seeing that experience and how many games have come, how many promos have come out, how many have been created since then? I imagine it's a great feeling, but I'm just curious to hear what you think.
Yeah, I mean, this game overall is full of surprises. Like, it wasn't intended to be a game that we even published in the first place. And then It wasn't a game that I intended to add realms based on games designed by other people, like other publishers or released by other publishers. And then on top of that, like you said, 100 plus realms just created for fun and shared. And I play them every 10 live streams. I'll pick nine of those realms and play with those realms. So yeah, it's been, I'll spoil something and say that Rolling Realms, I ranked it number one on my list just because it's been the most surprising game of ours that we've played, and I play it the most. So
yeah.
So that is Rolling Realms ranked number eight on. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Ranking all Rolling Realms would be a nice idea for the next video.
That would be tricky to do. Maybe I'll try to do that for fun someday. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's Rolling Realms at number eight. And we'll move on to the most recent game we released, number seven. This one could potentially be higher over time, but it is fairly new. Wormspan. Wormspan is our number seven. So this is a engine building game, tableau building, engine building game that's card driven. It's inspired by the Wingspan platform, but it is its own game in many different ways. And it's been fun to see people discover this game. It's a little bit heavier than Wingspan, and it isn't, it's based on dragons, not something that we can look out our windows and see like the birds of Wingspan. Have any of you played Wormspan fairly recently and would like to say something about it?
Yeah, I played it not that long ago. I had it ranked higher than this. I played it earlier than most because I did some of the play testing for the solo mode. But then after that, when it came out, it was a definite recommend. It would have been so easy to just reskin Wingspan and change nothing, but it does feel fresh. It feels like a brand new game, but still familiar enough to Wingspan that you can see that it shares the same pedigree with a new person in there designing. It just takes Wingspan and elevates it to a level that people that are a little bit more familiar with games can play around with the space a lot more. And then the components are delightful. And I just love the theme with the dragons that are not off killing everybody, but they're more, more just if dragons were like birds and they were just there. I love the mining and then preparing the caves for the dragons, and how that's not just you play a card down, but there's something you get out of preparing the cave as well. It's just, I like, even though I've only played the game multiplayer one time, it's familiar enough to Wingspan that I know that it's way high on my list, and I don't yet own it, but it is in my game group, so it's accessible.
I really think it's a strange beast. Like the first time I played it, I began by explaining, well, this is like Wingspan bot, but then halfway through it was just, that is confusing. This is a different game. It's not Wingspan with, and on paper, it's more complex because you have to dig the caves before you can add the dragons. But then playing it the 5-6 times I've tried it, every time people grasp it faster than they grasp Wingspan for some reason, it's like, all right, I need dragons in hand, I need resource, I need a cave explore. Done, and when I've done that, I can send my little dude to go cave digging. That makes sense. For some reason, it's more complex than Wingspan, but whenever I teach it, it's an easier teach, and people are 2-3 rounds in, they're already making like improved decisions, I would say. And it's there's something intuitive about Wormspan. And I still really enjoy Wingspan with all the expansions and that big pile of birds with everything going on and cross-referencing, but it's, for some reason, it's a more complex game that's easier to get into.
That's neat to hear. Well, we have a connection between the number seven and number six games on this list because they're from the same designer. I'm finding that Connie Volgeman is one of my favorite people to work with. She also designed Apiary, which is our space bee themed game that we released late last year. It's a worker placement game that is full of positive player interaction. It's a competitive game, but there's so many things that you can do in this game where the thing that you do it benefits one or more other players in the game. Chris, let's see, who hasn't talked for a little while? Christian, do you have any thoughts on Apiary?
Yeah, yes, sure. I actually ranked it a little bit higher than that. I love the game. It took me one trailer to go from, that's an interesting theme, to Art Genius. And then I was lucky enough to showcase it on the Stonemaier booth last year in Essen many, many times. And since then, it's been, I think, the most played game in our group returning. I like the theme, as I said, it's awesome. And generally the space, the explore action is so somatic in my opinion. And you have lots of different paths to victory. In the most recent games, I gravitate more to the seed cards and do a lot of things with those. Yeah, just very, very good game. Yeah.
Awesome. Michael or Jonathan, do you have anything to add about Apiary?
This one's actually was my number three, and it's one game that always fits in that category for me and my wife. My primary gaming group is two, and it plays really well at two players. And we always find ourselves trying our hardest to extend the game just a little bit longer. Like, how do I keep my bees from hibernating? Because I have two more tiles that I desperately want to play. And it's one of the games that really doesn't let you do that, which is huge for us. We play Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition, and we've used half the deck because neither of us wants to do the actions phase. So this one has a really good forced pacing built into it.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for sharing your thoughts on Apiary. That's at number six on the list. At number five, we have the game that I designed as a follow-up, as a sequel to Scythe, and that is Expeditions. Expeditions is an exploration engine building game driven by cards. On your turn, you're taking one of three actions. So you're either playing a card and activating that card, you're moving, or you are gathering benefits from the hex that you're on. Have any of you played Expeditions recently? Jonathan, you talked about Tricarion a second ago, but have you played Expeditions in a little while?
Yes, yeah, recently. And as you mentioned, I like a lot of the Stonemaier games, it's so easy to me to learn and teach new people. You know, it's something that you can get on the table, you watch a video or you skim through the rules and you can really get started. The actions are very straightforward, what you're doing. And I love the artwork of, we're going to talk about Scythe at some point, but that world is just so much fun, and seeing a new twist to the gameplay in that world has been a blast. You know, can't wait to see what happens with the expansion sometime soon, of course, but just the base game, there's so much replayability, so many different ways to win. And it's been a lot of fun in our house for sure.
We will talk about Scythe in a little bit, but if anyone else has any thoughts about Expeditions that you think people should know about, feel free to let me know.
I have to say that as a player who loves tableau building, like really, that's maybe my favorite mechanism ever. This is what we call tableau crashing. So you build up your tableau, but then you have to crash it. You have to remove the cards from your tableau and then build it up. And if you just keep building, when do you release that tableau? So it's one of the few games I've seen where you're not just building up once or building up once and destroying once. You're constantly trying to figure out when to build up a bit more before you resolve it. It feels a bit like Steampunk Rally, which is more filler game in that regard, that you build up and constantly destroy what you're building. I really think that sets it apart.
I like that.
Yeah, I also like the mechanism in the boasting mechanism where you have to make these achievements, but you don't just get them when you get them. You have to go take the action to say that you've earned a star, and you have to maintain that condition until you do that. And you might be trying to get all the way across the board to the action space that lets you do that. It just, compared to Scythe, that just additional little bit is fun to explore too.
Yeah, even though Scythe is higher ranked both by ambassadors and in general, I tried to take a lot of those little lessons from Scythe and apply them to Expeditions. So that's Expeditions at number five. We have our last game in the 4 through 10 range. And this was a little bit of a surprise to me because this game has been by far our best-selling game, and that is Wingspan and the entire Wingspan line of games that we have here. Really high up on the list, four, but I kind of thought it might be in the top three, and it wasn't quite there. But Wingspan, similar to Wormspan, is a tableau building card-driven game where you're collecting birds and activating just a couple of different actions in the game as you build this tableau of birds. And one key difference, I didn't mention this with Wormspan, in Wingspan you have a set number of actions. All players take the exact same number of actions throughout the game. That can vary in Wormspan based on the coin system. But yeah, do any of you have any thoughts that you'd like to share that you think people should know about Wingspan, whether they're deep into the game or if they've never heard of it before?
I think the most unique part with the set number of actions that you mentioned with Wingspan is that it's also a diminishing number of actions. Yeah. So as the game goes on, each round you score a best of round. You actually use one of your action cubes to score that. So then the next round you only have, you have one less each time. So each round gets progressively tighter as you go, and it makes those choices a lot more important.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah, and part of the reason for that in the design is that design from Elizabeth Hargrave, I should mention the designer because she did an incredible job in this game, is that your turns tend to get a little bit longer at the end of the game and more powerful. So we wanted to give players fewer turns. And some people have played a version of, or a fan, completely fan optional variant that I've never actually played, where they put two player mats side by side and play, I think they call it Mega Wingspan, where they keep on going in those rows and have really, really long rows. Have any of you played that variant? I've never
tried. No, I haven't. We did play about a month ago the seven-player flock mode, which was a unique experience. And it did get on the higher end of time, but because you have two people playing simultaneously, it didn't double the time at all. Yeah, the Wingspan just hits the table so much, and because there are so many copies out in the world, it's easy to find people that know how to play. If you want a game that you don't have to teach, it's one that is often the case. But it's not that hard to teach either.
Awesome, yeah. I'm grateful as a publisher that we have Wingspan, and that has brought joy to a lot of different tabletops worldwide, and that has opened up doors to things like Wormspan and other games. All right, we're going to get to the top three now. And for the top three, it's just a free-for-all. You all can say anything you want about these games. And when I sense that you're done saying whatever you think is your favorite thing about it, the most important thing people should know, it's also okay to criticize these games if you think there's something people should know, or that there's maybe some people who wouldn't connect with these games that you want to mention. Anything goes. So the number three spot here goes to Viticulture, the very first release that we had. It's a game that has a number of expansions now, so it's been kept alive over the years, but it was my first published design, our first Kickstarter, and it was released in 2013. So Viticulture is a worker placement game for 1 to 6 players where you're building up a vineyard and through worker placement and trying to have the most glory or claim for your vineyard. Yeah. Any thoughts on Viticulture?
Yeah, maybe I'll start. It's also my number three of all games. A game that drew me into modern board game was Agricola, but unfortunately that didn't click with so many people from my regular gaming group. So I had to find a new worker placement game that's a little bit less restrictive, and Agricola was the perfect fit for that. We still play it from time to time. We are happy about all the game modes you can choose from, and whenever we are a big group with new players, I propose Viticulture, and we're good to go because it's easy to teach, and in my opinion you can add Tuscany probably right from the get-go. Love it still.
Yeah, I think Viticulture is our go-to double date night game. My brother and our wives, both, all of them love to play this game. Jamie's suggestion of teaching the game backwards, where you start with the contracts and then you go to how you make wine and then you go to how you make grapes, and just that advice and how to teach the game makes it flow pretty easily. I know Jamie says that you should start with the base game, but I also throw Tuscany in because that's how I learned it, with Tuscany in from the beginning. And then there's options to take out some detail if you don't want it, like the little regional star placement thing. There's a side of the board without that on that. And that, take it or leave it. There's a bunch of different visitor packs that have been released. You're supposed to pick one set of visitors, but we don't really care about game balance. We just throw them all in. it's just a nice, relaxing. I love the theme.
As the building on that, it's so intuitive to explain to people what you're doing. And there are a lot of, like you mentioned, the Agricola. You can of course tell people, well, you're farmers, you need to do this and that, but that's a pretty wide open space. Like making wine, all right, cutting it down, you need to sell your wine, produce it, make grapes, have somewhere to store it, done. Mm-hmm. So it's a game that really, with the expansion, increases in complexity. But most of the rules are adding to that basic progression of what you're trying to do. They're not offshoots or different things that just, oh, you need to make more money, or you need to increase your wine storage facilities, or whatever you want to do. It's still building on that basic premise of this is the 3-4-step thing you're going through. And everything else you do in the game is just helping you do that. It's not distracting from it or making you do some mini game on another board. It's the same thing you're doing every turn you have an action.
Yeah, a lot of those expansions just allow you to get those green cards when you need them, things like that. Yeah. That you're already, it's already part of the base. It just expands it. And I really do appreciate the Essentials Edition, because as Viticulture was your first design, some of the other expansions are not quite so essential, and you don't need to go get the Fromage expansion or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's one where you can add an expansion or two from those, that essential line, and it really takes off.
I'm interested in how everyone is doing in Viticulture world, losing or winning the scenarios, because our group hasn't been so good with those.
Holy.
It feels like we're about to lose every time we play, but we somehow eke it out most times. We haven't made it through all the continents yet, but yeah. It's... And I think the last, what was it? I think it was Asia. There was no chance. We just, whatever happened, there was. But that the world expansion has a great way to make it cooperative, but still feel like you're playing Viticulture, because you all have to have your own vineyard. You still have to do the normal Viticulture thing. It's a little bit disappointing that some of the Tuscany things are not in there. So I still tend to prefer the base with Tuscany, but it is, if you want something different, if you want to help each other out or find ways to, within the rules, help somebody else's vineyard, it's fun that you can just expand out in that direction.
It feels like 6-7 mini games based on this game. So it feels like these expansions where they say, all right, you play through all 7 continents. There are probably 2 or 3 you're never going to play again because you didn't like the space it opened. But there are 2 or 3 again that really changed the game for you. It feels like a different game, more or less, every time we play a new continent, I would say.
Well, it reminds me a lot of the solo series of games that are in the rule book, that you have the base game and with the solo rules, but you have some unique thing thrown in there. It's been a decade, but I think there's like 12 different things through the solo campaign. And if you haven't done it, it is worth the time. I had a lot of time when I was home on paternity leave, and I played through the whole series.
And one last thing about Viticulture that I'll throw in there for designers, that I stumbled upon in creating it and realized in hindsight that I really like it, is that Viticulture has a number of passive benefits. So once you've put grapes on your crush pad, or you've turned those grapes into wine, your grapes and wine age without you having to do anything, just by the passage of time. And I found that I really like that in games, where choosing to do something early in the game, you can make a grape in the first round, and it, by the time you actually need that grape, it might be valued at 7 or 8. And so with you not having to do anything, something is getting better in the game. And I found that I really like that in games. Thank you for your thoughts on Viticulture. I really appreciate that about the core game, the expansions, the cooperative expansion. Let's go on to number 2 here. This is the top ranked game on Board Game Geek from Stillmeyer Games, and that is Scythe. Scythe is an engine building game set in an alternate 1920 universe that has some combat in it, but it's a game that's more about the threat of combat than combat itself. And it's a game that I designed around the idea of, or eventually it realized that I designed it around the idea of double benefits, double rewards. So whenever you do anything in the game, or whenever you take a turn in the game, oftentimes you are doing 2 things instead of 1, and you're gaining multiple benefits, up to 2, maybe even 3 benefits that turn instead of just 1.
Scythe is my number 1 by far. It was no question. It was number 1, and then the rest of the list. It was, I backed the original Kickstarter.
I have all of, like, in my little scythe, I've got all my figures painted up. It was my first real big paint job. And it's amazing how it is so much a Euro. It is. It looks like an Amerithrash game where you're on the board fighting, but it's great how they reward you for fighting twice and then you're done. that there's reason to start a fight, but then it doesn't encourage you to beat somebody down. But really the meat in the game is the fact, like Jamie mentioned, that that's the double action sort of thing. And then while it seems like the different factions are where all the diversity in the game are going to be, yeah, the asymmetric powers are nice, but really the asymmetry comes in the board that you have. That everybody has the same 8 actions there, but how they're paired up together completely changes your strategy. Some boards you might have, when you upgrade, you get some bonus coins, but somebody else doesn't get any bonus coins. The cost will change. And then on the top of the board versus the bottom board, like if you have deploy, how you're building your mechs paired up with your production action, that means that it's going to be very easy to get the resources to do that action. So you might be the first one to get your mechs out, whereas on a different board, you're paired up with your building. So that's the strategy you pursue. And it's makes it a different game every time. And it's one that I've pursued a lot of crafting. I did the painting. I also, there's so many different resources. I went on Thingiverse and got all of these fun little 3D printed components for the buildings. And I've played this so many times. I do recommend, if you're new to it, the base game will entertain you for hours. If you want something beyond that, jump straight into the Fenris campaign. The other expansions, if you want more factions, they're good. But it is by far my most played, even amongst like Rolling Realms, which can hit the table so easily. Scythe is just glows so much that it hits the table all the time. It has been a while since it's not a new release anymore, but it is. I love it.
Besides number one for anyone else?
It was my number two.
My number two also.
I love how my number two. The expansions gave a lot of modular options to it. So I have everything in the big box. I made my own insert for it so that we can get to everything easier. I like that you can pull out and go, here's the base game. We want airships this time, so we're going to throw that in. Or next time, we don't want the airships, but we want some of the Fenris stuff thrown in. You can mix and match so easily with it, especially with the comprehensive rule books that have been put out. Having one of those on the table, you can just flip through usually the index. It's fantastic. One of my favorite little design pieces, kind of going back to Viticulture, the little glass beads from Viticulture. When they're placed on the board, they magnify the numbers in that game. We actually bought a second set and put them in Scythe to replace the expedition markers, and it just makes them kind of pop off of it. And one piece of advice, if you do, or when you get to the Rise of Fenris campaign, don't make the birthday wish of your wife and best friend playing through the whole thing in one day. And if you do read the rules correctly, we did not realize the alternate win conditions, so we just played full games for every single scenario. They did not like me by the end of that day.
For context, the Rise of Fenris is the last expansion in the game. It's an 8 game campaign. That was probably a fairly long day for you there.
I think it was about 14 hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those guys did a nice job summarizing the game. I guess for me, I had it as number two also. And it's the game that kind of one of those early Kickstarter games for me that got me into the hobby. So I always will credit Scythe for lots of fun and lots of playthroughs, of course, but it's how I discovered Stonemaier. I mean, it's the game that launched this ambassador and everything like that, supporting going back and getting Viticulture and Euphoria. And then we're going to talk about Tapestry obviously soon. So that's my number one. And it kickstarted everything else, I guess, for me with Stonemaier. So always will be fond memories of Scythe for me.
And the resources, they're beautiful, they're heavy, they're...
Yes.
Exactly. I wanted to say that, yeah. I have the same story as you just said. I just discovered Stonemaier that way, and I was thinking, wow, that game looks so cool. I don't know if my group's going to play that, and then I bought it, and it became the one of the most played games we've played, and a lot of first ones with this metal coins, premium resources, the box with everything in it. Yeah, lots of fun hours. And one game mechanism I really like is the tension for looming battles, I think, you say. They don't have to be battles, but yeah, you always think, am I going to do this? And what's going to happen to me then? That's very fun.
Exactly, that, because people think it's a war game where you present it, you have these mechs, you have these resources. I always present it like it's a Cold War 4X game. It's actually a Cold War civilization game. So yeah, there is combat, but it's probably going to hurt you more than it hurts them. And the moment you attack, you're in a very weak position. Yeah, you need to go out and get resources, but only just what you need. And then you need to move back and condense. So it's this Cold War tension building up faster than your opponent, instead of just building up until you surpass them and then wagging them to the floor. So that's one of the most interesting things, I think.
And one of the consequences is the loss of popularity. If you attack someone who has, or if you might position yourself on the board so you have some workers with you, and that is a reason for others not to attack
you. Yeah, I just love the human shield aspect of just your army plus one worker.
Let's move on to number one. You can tell it's the last game left here. So this is Tapestry. Tapestry is the civilization game that I always wanted to exist, because I wanted a civilization game that wasn't based on real world history. I wanted to create my own history in the game, following things that happen in the real world, different inventions, things like that. But it is a track-based game where you are on your turn. All you're doing is choosing one of four tracks. You're choosing one of four tracks, five with one of the expansions, and you're advancing to space on that track and gaining the corresponding benefit. How many of you picked Tapestry as your number one? Show of hands here. Okay. So this was the biggest surprise to me on this list, because the top-ranked games that we have on Board Game Geek are Wingspan, Viticulture, and Scythe. Tapestry isn't even close to that, but it was neat to hear what you all thought about that. So what are your thoughts on Tapestry?
Well, at least 4-1, we can agree we picked the right number one.
Hey.
The one I hear the most attention about in forums. So I'm happy to see it number one.
Yeah. Well, I think Tapestry got a lot of early pushback because people hear Civilization and they think Sid Meier's Civilization, which is not what a Civilization game is. But if you have that feeling, if you just take that out of the mix, it is a fantastic game. I'll let somebody who ranked it first talk more.
Yeah, I can jump in. So, I mean, Tapestry, I had it as my number one. It's easily by far the most played game I have. A lot of that's thanks to the base game being on Board Game Arena. So if you're interested in that game, that's a great platform to go and check it out, learn the base game, play with, you know, similar people that are looking to learn to play the game. Gosh, I think I've probably played it coming up on 1,000 times. So it's easily the most played. And then each expansion that's come out, I mean, it just adds so much more replayability. The arts track is fantastic. Each new civilization is so much fun to puzzle out. And then recently with the revised civilization pack, some of those base game civs are almost brand new. I mean, it's like discovering a brand new civ and comparing it against something that came out in Futures and Fantasy. So it's just, there's so much fun to be had there. I can see, I'm very delighted to see it was number one among the ambassadors here too. Just knowing how much I've enjoyed it, and just appreciate you, Jamie, for creating this game, because it's brought a lot of joy to me and family and friends. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I've taught at a number of conferences and game conventions. And every time a teacher would say, well, either you take one of these, you take a turn advancing or you take a turn of income. All right, that's it. Yeah, that's it. And here's a sheet that tells everything. And I'm going to go through four actions. And those are the four actions of the whole game. Everything else is a variation thereof. And then the most common heard criticism I get is, well, it's called Tapestry. Why do I only get to play 3-4 Tapestry cards, maybe 5-6? Well, first, the expansions add on that. And second, it is called Tapestry, but Tapestry is just a small part of it. It is a resource manipulation, time manipulation, race game to some extent. But it is an abstract Civ game, but I really like Civ games, but I really like that Tapestry does something different than most other civilization games. It does a tiny bit of everything. It has everything you need, like theme-wise, in a civilization game, but it does something different with it. And as a fan of asymmetry, there's a your civilization says a lot, your territory says a lot, and it's just a game of playing the hand you're dealt more than building up that perfect theoretical hand that some other games have you do.
I think that's my favorite part of it, is that it's, you have to adapt constantly in the game. Right from the beginning, we play the draw two civilizations and pick one. Just right from there, you have to completely change what you did last time to the next time. Maybe one was a science heavy track, this one's arts, this one's tech. Making the choice of which track to go down first. Some people always go science, but that first science space scares me every time. It's based on what tapestry cards you draw, what tech cards are available. Everything is going to change how you approach each game. So even if you've played it hundreds of times, there's something fresh each time.
Yeah, and what your opponents do, like if you have two opponents out of three doing more or less the same thing as you in the first round, already there you're changing your strategy. Like a lot of Civ games, you play, I don't know, a third of the game before you even reach each other. Here it's immediate. The first player making the first track move changes someone's strategy before they even had their first turn. And that it also, because those tracks are built into tiers, so there's like a bonus for being the first one to hit every third step. Every time someone is the first one in the next tier, that immediately makes it less attractive for everyone else to go up. But if you really need to do it, and the final thing is that because prices go up the higher you go until the end where they're actually like mathematically lowered a little bit, it's a push to get to the end of a track. And then it's a somewhat sweeter ride through the end. So it's, if a lot of games with tracks just make it progressively more expensive to get up a track, and then you never reach the end. Where here, if you can pass that third tier hurdle, it's more or less a sail to the end.
I do feel like Tapestry also has the highest player interaction of the Stonemaier catalog.
Yeah. I love that.
You were going to say something. Oh, sorry, Chris.
Yeah. I just love that the race for the landmarks kind of makes you all do something different at the table. And the arts and architecture expansion, adding that fifth track, means that with a five-player game, you can all chase one track. But then, unlike a lot of the games, like, you really push to make non-optimal turns. Like, if you want to wait until you can get every benefit, like, this is the landscape I want to chase, this is the action I want to do, this is the building I need to have to do this. If you're waiting for the perfect storm, somebody's going to beat you. Somebody's going to beat you to the race, and you just have to take turns that are good enough. And if you try and spread out all across all the tracks, you're not going to get to the end of any of them. So you really need to just make a decision and go with it.
Christian, you were going to say something there as well.
You all said so many valid points already. It's not only my favorite Stonemaier game, it's actually my favorite game of all time currently. I still have memory when I saw a playthrough by John Gets Games. I normally don't watch playthrough of board games, but my wife came in and I was right at the end of the video and I told her, I think this is the best board game I've ever seen. showcased. Yeah. Maybe some things to add. The tactile experience is also great, and the combos you get, the middle section, the area where everyone's competing for space. Still every time I play it, I think I've achieved something, even though I'm way far behind those top scores on Board Game Arena. I think 340 is my high score currently. That's good. When I remember, first game was 78 points. Also, the game came out during the first COVID lockdown in Germany. So there's quite a memory there. We played it a lot in those first weeks. Yeah, maybe every evening or so. Yeah.
One other gameplay thing I wanted to mention in the Plans Employees expansion, I love the landmark cards that you can start the game with. I think that was just a brilliant way especially for higher player counts, right? When there's a lot of competition for those landmarks, and you can sometimes get edged out where you just don't quite make it at the time, your timing's off. But having one landmark that you draft at the beginning and you know you're guaranteed to get, usually mid-game, because they're usually pretty attainable goals that you're going to naturally get throughout the game. Having something like that dedicated to you is so nice. It just helps your capital city and help the combos of points in those late eras. So I just wanted to highlight that one because I just think that's a really brilliant design add that the Plans Employees expansion added to the game.
And thank you for not making the science die a D4.
My favorite die to roll is a D12. So I wanted a D12 somewhere in the game, even though it is essentially a D4 die. Well, I really appreciate, before we wrap up, I appreciate all of your thoughts on the games that we've talked about today. I wanted to see, I'll just show the chart here for the end here. Any closing thoughts of anything that surprised you as to like where different games are on the chart? And I will say for anyone watching this video who maybe hasn't played any or many of these games, you're listening to people who are pretty invested in Stonemaier games. These are all ambassadors here who have played all 17 of our games. So this isn't necessarily the best list for you, but it is something to consider if you're thinking about buying a Stonemaier game. Any thoughts as you all look at this list? How it worked out?
I'm still surprised that Territories is the first one. Like, disclaimer, I've been an editor on the Ultima rules for all expansions, and I've done a lot of work with Morten Monod Pedersen, who does them. But still, even though it's one of my favorite games, I would assume that something like Wingspan or maybe Scythe or the excellent B game, or maybe Rolling Realms, due to like how many people have played it, would be ranked high. Because every time I play Territory with someone, they always bid, well, it's not really a civilization game and something. it's I'm actually surprised to see the game I put number one be the overall number one. But it just shows like that's just such a great game. Such a great game.
Agreed.
Yeah. I'm not at all surprised by anything on the top because any of them could have been. The bottom was painful because amongst this list of games, not to make Jamie blush too much, but I love every one of them. And it was really hard to put things like in the 14, 15. It's like, because in its the diversity of your game profile is there are different games that I'll play with different groups. I love taking out Between Two Cities with large groups of non-gamers because there's that built-in helper because you're working with your neighbor at every step of the game. I love My Little Scythe for kids, Smitten if you have two players in a few minutes. Like every one of them is like this bottom of the list is the top of so many other lists.
I can echo that. I think I said that in email. It was very difficult to rank these because truly love them all, would happily play any of them with anyone at any time. So just a testament to the lineup.
Well, you all have certainly made my week by saying so many nice things about our games. I knew I was kind of setting myself up with that with this the video and to feel a little awkward while doing so, but I really appreciate you taking your time to not only rank the games, but also share your insights with people who are watching this, whether they've played these games or haven't played them. I'm excited to see in the comments how people who watch this video, feel free to rank our games if you have played them or ask questions about any of the games on this list if you haven't played them. We're happy to answer them. And I hope you all have a wonderful week and a wonderful day as well. Thank you so much for joining me for today's conversation.
Thank you
for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Bye.